Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What's going on, people? I'm your host, Jay Painting. This is the Paint Points Podcast, proudly part of the Tainus Hoopers family and the SB Nation Podcast Network. As always, you can find my written work over at tainushoopers.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Jake Painting, JakePaynting. Today is going to be focused on the potential return, price point, skill set, fit, all of that on Timberwolves big man Juancho Hernangómez. Joining me to cover all this will be a very special guest. He writes really awesome work over at Dunking with Wolves. He's Jack Borman. What's going on, Jack?
I'm doing well, Jake. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad. How's everything going over there right now with isolation and no basketball and everything kind of in the air?
You know, it's been pretty good. You know, everybody in my family is doing well, and you know, that's just about all I could ask for. And you know, this past Monday, things started to open up here in Minnesota. So that's a good sign, hopefully. And hopefully, you know, everybody goes about it responsibly. And you know, we can keep on kind of getting a little bit closer to normal life. And hopefully, we'll have some Timberwolves basketball to watch here in about 6 weeks. So.
Yeah, it looks like we're getting closer to NBA basketball, which is good for the mental stress, good for something to do, good for the league. So hopefully that all pans out well, and maybe by mid late July we get to watch some basketball at the latest. Yep. So today, like I said, we'll go into Juancho Hernangómez. I know you've got thoughts on him, I've got thoughts on him. So I'll just start with a bit of background information, obviously. So he was traded to Minnesota in that 14 deal with Malik Beasley, Jared Vanderbilt. A bunch of other players went out. Robert Covington ended up in Houston. So he was part of that deal. He's 24 years old, 6'9", 220 pounds. He played 14 games for Minnesota after the trade deadline, which most of you obviously know. Averaged 29.4 minutes, 12.9 points, 7.3 rebounds, 1.3 assists, a steal, and 0.5 blocks per game. Shot 45.3% from the field, 42% from deep. Shot around 5 attempts per game, I think, from 3.
Yep.
If that was expanded out to a full season, all of those numbers would have been career highs. So obviously he hasn't got the minutes or the time with Denver to really make his mark yet, but he did play pretty well for his usual standard when he did get to Minnesota. He'll be a restricted free agent, which, again, most of you probably know that. When free agency does roll around eventually, Minnesota will have his bird rights. They'll have the first option to match any offer sheet that he signs. So basically, they've got first dibs on Hernangómez when free agency does come around. So if they want him and they deem the price point suitable, then he probably will come back to Minnesota if that's what they want. But we're here to kind of discuss whether that will be the right move, I guess. So what are your thoughts on him, Jack?
Well, my thoughts are just, you know, first off, I think it was really encouraging that, you know, he saw a huge uptick in his workload once he got traded here to Minnesota. You know, you're talking about a 12 minutes per game increase, and, you know, the guy took pretty much twice as many overall shots from the floor, almost twice as many threes. And, you know, and he did get to the line three and a half times a game, which I think is encouraging. And you know, I think that there were some actions that you know, that the Timberwolves were able to run, specifically, you know, when they ran Juancho off screens and handoff actions.
Yeah.
And he was also really, really good, in the pick and roll as, you know, as the roll man, either as a popper or slipper or, you know, just your standard, you know, pick and roller, you know, which I think were all really, really encouraging. You know, I think that, you know, one thing that stuck out to me kind of when I was, you know, digging into it a little bit is, you know, when I was watching some of these last 14 games, you know, just because I've had all the time in the world and have rewatched some of them, you know, I really started to notice, you know, gosh, this, all of his threes are just wide open shots. Which I think was huge. And you know, when you get it, when you're out there playing with a point guard that's as manipulative and as crafty and creative as D'Angelo Russell, when he has a ball screen, you know, it really allows, you know, the guy that he's kind of playing a two-man game with to work his way open, which was sweet. And so, you know, 74% of his catch and shoot opportunities were uncontested, and that's from Synergy. You know, shot 43% on him. He had a 65% effective field goal percentage. And that put him in the 75th percentile league-wide. So so that was really encouraging. And from a three-point, you know, perspective, I think he'll probably come back down to earth a little bit just because, you know, he hasn't had a season shooting, you know, any more than, you know, really like 123s shooting, you know, higher than, you know, 37%. So, you know, I hope that was a byproduct of the Minnesota system and playing with a really, really creative lead guard like Russell. And, you know, hopefully that's something that can carry forward if he does return. But obviously, you know, defense is a whole nother ball game when you're talking about Wancho. So, but I'm sure that we'll get into that.
Yeah. I think, like you said, he seems to fit pretty seamlessly next to Russell. Obviously, he only played the one game with Towns, so that we don't really know how well he fit next to Towns, but he seemed to fit very well next to D'Angelo Russell. He gives them a really good option in pick and roll. Like you said, he slips that ball screen really well. Last night, I tweeted about the way Minnesota like to run this horns kind of action where a ball screen comes from on both sides of D'Angelo Russell, and they'll have in most instances while they're together, it was Naz Reid and Wancho that have Reid on the left, Wancho on the right. Reid would set the screen and Wancho would just come into the screen, slip straight away and dive to the rim. And that seemed to really work well, especially with the way that Russell can fire passes out of pick and rolls without kind of looking at him or telegraphing the pass. So the shooting stroke really good, like you said, a lot of open shots. He seems to get himself open really well, moves to get into line with the ball handler, so he can make himself available really well. I like that. I think, like you said as well, I don't think he's quite as good as a 42% shooter. I'd be surprised if that didn't regress a little bit, but any even slight regression back to, you know, 40-38% is still a really good number if he's shooting pretty high volume. Apart from that, we'll stay on the offense for now, but I'm not overly impressed with the rest of his offensive game. I think he's a good cutter and he slips well, good shooter, but he's really bad around the rim. He shot 49.5% at the rim this season. The league average is 57.9%, so almost 10 percentage points below league average. So that's really bad for a guy who's 6'9", 6'10". Seems to miss a lot of bunnies and rushes, like a lot of easy finishes. So gets a bit of tunnel vision when he's going toward the rim. I don't know if that was to do with his playing for a contract, a bit like Malik Beasley was kind of really focused on scoring because they're obviously playing for their first big contract. But what else did you see from him offensively that I guess you didn't like?
Well, the main thing that I had on top of my list was exactly what you just said. I thought he did a great job, like you said, of making himself available. And when he slipped, he'd do a really great job of getting his head turned around, or, you know, staying open so that his shoulders were square to, you know, the direction that the pass was going to come from. And he has great hands, which helps. And obviously, you know, if your hands aren't up and you're not able to corral the pass, then, you know, your slip is pretty useless. And, you know, one thing too that, you know, that I just kind of grew frustrated was that he just kind of expected contact to come a lot of times without going into a body of a defender. And when
he often kind of goes around the defender or tries to double clutch, you know, when they're not even, when the defense isn't even that strong. And I think that throws him off rather than just trying to get that bucket and not worry about the defense as much.
Right. Because if you go in assuming that you're going to get hit and you just go in strong, you take it strong, you know, keep your shoulders square to the basket, you know, then you're going to have no problem finishing, even if the defender doesn't come and doesn't body up or you don't get fouled or what have you. And so that's something that I'd really like to see Juancho work on. And the other thing that I think that Juancho needs to work on as well is just his passing. You know, I think that sometimes when he got the ball, he just didn't really know what to do with it. If he wasn't open to just shoot the ball right away, and he would, a lot of times if he got the ball kind of above the break or, you know, on one side or the other, kind of at the, you know, where the, you know, 3-point line kind of starts to bend into the corner. You know, a lot of times he'd just get the ball and kind of, you know, just hold it in his hands and kind of move it up and down, waiting for, you know, someone to get open or some guy to come curl around him on a handoff. And, you know, I'd like to, you know, see him be a little bit more aggressive going to the rim. And if he's shying away from contact or he doesn't feel confident finishing, then, you know, trying to get the ball into the middle and jump stopping and surveying the floor and kind of, you know, seeing what his options are. Because when you're flanked by, you know, a Towns, a Russell, a Beasley, and a Kogi, even when he's in the corner, or Culver, hopefully we get the last 14 games of Jarrett Culver, he can actually shoot the ball. And you get people like that around you, you know, those are all guys that are capable of knocking down an open jump shot. But just kind of standing there, you know, hoping for help to come, you know, isn't a great thing. You know, hope isn't a strategy. And so I'd like to see him be a little bit more decisive with what he's doing. Cause when he's within the flow of the offense and they're running a specific action, you know, you can tell that he knows exactly what he's supposed to do and he's good at executing it. But I think when you're going to get guys like Russell and Towns, you're going to get guys that are going to go off script a little bit, and Beasley too, if he's going to, you know, have the ball in the perimeter. And, you know, I think, you know, the ability to just kind of, you know, play, you know, together as one with, you know, new guys is tough to do if you've got free flow and offense and you've only played together for 15 games. So, you know, if he does come back, I'd hope that, you know, he can kind of understand their tendencies a little bit better and kind of become a better cutter, because his cutting numbers, you know, weren't very good this year. And, you know, or even just making himself available in different spots on the floor where he can then, you know, make an extra pass or two. So those are things that I'd look for Juancho to get better at on the offensive end of the floor, because, you know, he only had 1.3 assists per game, which, like, sure, that's a career high, great pat on the back for Juancho, but you know, for a guy who's playing 30 minutes a game, with shooters all around him, that number should be closer to 3 or 3.5 or 4. So
I think that's I think it's a really good point, the how little he got into drive and kick action. Like you said, when he wasn't coming off screens or finding himself open for a catch and shoot, and he just got the ball and the play's broken down and he doesn't exactly know, he doesn't have it, you know, that planned action already for him, and he just has to create a little bit. Instead, he wouldn't kick the ball off quick enough. Like, if you're not going to drive and kick yourself or try and get past your man or try and do something that's going to kickstart the offense a little bit, get it to someone who can. Or if you think you can do it yourself, I think he needed to go get past his man, or at least try and beat his man, collapse the defense, and then kick it out to those shooters. Like you said, you've got so many good shooters around, especially when Towns is there, if he ever does play with Towns again. Drive and kick it was such an important action for this team. It's such a simple concept, and it's such a good way to get the ball in rotation, to get the defense scrambling. And I really didn't like the way he kind of, like you said, he just pounded the ball or hesitate for too long and didn't kind of get into that drive and kick action quick enough.
Yeah, and you know, I think that, you know, like I said, I think part of it has to do with the fact that he only played 14 games, and it's probably pretty tough.
Yeah, it's hard to really, you know, put a black mark against his name for that when no one knew what they were doing together. They didn't get a training camp. They didn't get any time to gel together, except for maybe a you know, 5-day all-star break. So it is quite harsh on him, but that's, you know.
Well, yeah, where are the Bahamas when you need it? But, but you know, the other thing, too, I mean, just thinking about a basic drive and kick. I mean, I can go to the gym with buddies or, you know, just go hopping and run fives at school with, you know, people I don't know. And everybody's driving and kicking. Like, it's one of the most basic things that you don't even necessarily need to know where people are going to be. If you're able
to... You need a scheme for it.
Yeah, if you're just able to keep your head up while you're dribbling and know where kind of guys are on the floor, come to a jump stop or kind of jump and then throw that over the head pass like a lot of wings or fours or centers do if they drive the ball to the cup. You know, it's a basic thing that, you know, I'd hope that, you know, just watching film is probably the easiest fix for that. But, you know, especially if you're playing around, you know, a megastar and Cat and a, you know, an all-star and D'Lo, you know, those are guys where, you know, the defense is going to, you know, be stretched out on them. And if you get in there, you know, you'll be able to have guys like a Kogi and Beasley, who are two very good cutters, cutting to the rim. And even Culver, you know, I think Culver did a good job of really cutting and flashing to the rim the last, you know, 15 games of the year. So, you know, even if it's a, you know, you jump stop at the free throw line, you can kind of throw a side bounce pass to the block to a cutter, you know, that'd be awesome. And I think it's really just the passing and, you know, feeling safe to take three or four hard dribbles into the paint and go into someone's body or jump stop and pump fake. I mean, that's just simple fundamental stuff that I think kind of goes by the wayside sometimes in the NBA game, just because the speed of it. And especially for a guy who's not very athletic. You know, I think a great way that you can give yourself an advantage, especially against, you know, undisciplined defenders, is just to be able to go back to the basics, jump stop in the lane, pump fake, survey your options, keep your elbows out. Like, it sounds dumb, you know, it sounds like sixth grade basketball analysis, but it's stuff that really does work. So those are just simple things that, you know, I'm confident that you could fix just because, you know, it's something that you or I could do, but yeah, you know, all we can do is hope.
Yeah, exactly. And overall, I think if he can shoot as well as he did, ultimately those concerns are washed away a little bit, because this team needs good shooters. Good shooters around Towns is what we've been crying out for seasons. So if he can hit 40% of his threes at a decent volume, he's always going to have value. But I don't think he's ultimately the perfect fit next to Towns unless he can do a bunch of other things as well. And one of
you ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Those things is obviously play defense, which is a good segue into that. Pretty much, I think he's a... From, like you said, I've been watching the last 14 games, trying to, especially with an eye for Juancho, because I knew we were doing this coming up, and he's a disaster on defense. It sounds harsh, I guess, but from what I've seen, he's not anything close to the guy you want partnering Towns. He's got pretty slow feet, which kills him against mobile kind of fours or big wings. I watched the game against Boston last night, and They had him guarding Tatum, Hayward, or Brown, you know, and all of the wings kind of rotating between those three. And Tatum, like, he guarded Tatum probably 60% of the time he was on the court, and he just got obliterated every single time, which is obviously a really tough matchup for any four. But that's the kind of guys that you're going to face if you're a four in the NBA, especially with the way the league's going. The way Minnesota want to play is the same, with those kind of three wings, one big, one guard. And, like, he's going to get destroyed by those kind of guys every time. And then against the teams that are bigger, your Philadelphia, your Lakers, he's going to get killed on the other end of the spectrum, where he can't guard, you know, 6'11", 250-pound dudes, because he's not big enough. His arms aren't long enough. His feet are still very slow. His size just hurts him either way. He's in that really bad, I think, tweener kind of size, and his instincts and stuff aren't good enough to make up for it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my big thing is, you know, one, you're at a disadvantage if you're not in the same, the same plane athletically as, you know, your average four. You know, your average four is a guy that's about 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", who, you know, maybe a guy more like Vanderbilt, who's more like that, who's really agile, horizontally and can stick with guys. Like, if you're not there athletically, you sure as hell better, you know, be built like a brick house from your waist up, and you better have really strong legs.
Just have out of the world defensive IQ.
Yeah, and so I that kind of led in the next thing I was going to say is, you damn well better make sure that nobody's going to go through you. And the other thing you can do to help is, if you're not playing on the ball, you're a pass or two passes away, you can make sure that you're not too far up the line, meaning that you're not too far away from the basket and kind of out towards the 3-point line, so that a guy can't just catch and rip and blow by you for a layup. Your positioning has to be great. You have to know where you have to know where to be at all times, and you got to make sure that guys that are smaller than you, like a Tatum, theoretically, I mean, obviously it's kind of a really tough example there, but you know, if you're guarding a guy that's like 6'6", you switch on to a guy that's 6'6", and the guy's just powering through you, but he's also faster than you, then you've got no shot.
Yeah.
You know, if you're also on the floor with a guy like D'Angelo Russell, you know, who people are also going to go through, then you've got problems. Because it just comes down to, I mean, how many negative defenders can you have out there? I think you can really only have one, maybe two negative defenders out there if you want to be able to stay afloat, you know, defensively and hold on to any leads you have. And that's just not something that I've seen from Lancho, in a sense that, you know, he's not always in the best position. You know, he can get killed on the offensive glass. And you know, guys just blow by him. I mean, even guys that are supposed to be his size, he gets blown by him. And like you said, if there's a guy that's 6'10", 250, like if Dwight Howard, right in that range, is playing out there, and they have Dwight and JaVale out there for some reason, or they have
Or
there's a team in the playoffs. No. Like if you're Golden State, in Golden State, you know, you play Golden State in a 4-5 matchup next year, by the grace of God, you're the 5 seed, and you end up playing Golden State, or a 3-6 or whatever you have. And, you know, they have Marquise Chris out there with James Wiseman. You know, because they're gonna be able to play
Draymond Green.
Yeah, I mean,
Draymond Green in that situation is way too strong for one.
Yeah, going to the hole. I mean, Draymond just puts his head down. He's just a 260-pound bowling ball that'll just go right through you, and he's nimble enough and a good enough finisher where he has no problem doing that. So you know, the fact that he really can't guard anybody smaller than him, and he can't guard anybody his size or bigger than him, you know, if he comes back, his role's really got to just be, you know, what mine was in sixth grade, is you can't guard anybody. Just go stand in the corner, wait for somebody to pass you the ball and shoot. You know, it's tough. And I wish that Wancho was better, because, you know, he's fun, and it's fun to just see those, you know, rainbow threes that he has just drop through the net. But you know, at the end of the day, if you can't lace him up and go get in somebody's jock and stop him from scoring, I mean, you just can't be on the floor. and you know, it sounds blunt, but it's just where it is, considering the position that the Timberwolves are in terms of having probably a top 6 pick, another pick at 16 that they'd be able to use on somebody who can, you know, do those things. And you know, potentially having, you know, a mid-level exception, you know, close to $9 million to spend in free agency. So I mean, yeah, it's like you said, it's just kind of a nightmare on defense.
Yeah, and it's just, with this team being so disastrous defensively, it's almost the worst situation you could envision for a guy like Wancho, because, like you said, he's got really tantalizing skills on offense mainly, and theoretically they fit next to Towns really well offensively, because Towns can do so much to cover the things that that Juancho can't do offensively, and then he can just bang triples all night. But you just, you can't afford to have any more, you know, sieves defensively next to Towns and Russell, especially in the pick and roll. Obviously, Russell's going to be at the point of attack a lot of the time in pick and roll. And if they're running pick and roll, 1-4 pick and rolls with Juancho as the big defender, he can't guard between two players. He doesn't block shots at the rim. He can't kind of, you know what I mean, like stay between two and stop the big, but also corral the point guard. And Russell's going to get knocked off most of the time or play a bit of lazy D. And when Russell is already putting you at a disadvantage, the last thing you need is a guy like Juancho who can't make up for any of that disadvantage at all on his end.
Yeah.
So I just think that...
And I like that point because, you know, we can sit here and talk about, you know, when the lights come on and you know, you're playing an isolation game and Juancho's the guy that gets singled out. I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and say, you know, well, yeah, Juancho's probably going to get scored on. But, you know, I like to think about it in the context of lineups, like you're talking about. Like, he fits with them on offense. But if you're going to have Juancho out there on offense with Cat and D'Lo, you know, who are two guys that you probably need to throw in there, you know, so you can survive defensively? So you need to start thinking about lineup combinations where Juancho's, you know, abilities and you know, all the great things that he does as a shooter on offense can be kind of highlighted and uplifted while also mitigating the issues that he has on defense. And like you were saying, you know, a 1-4 pick and roll is one of the most common actions in the entire NBA. And if he's getting thrown into that, you know, that's tough because then there's no real way to mitigate that. I mean, sure, you can have Towns kind of creep over if, you know, there's a team playing a more traditional five that's not going to be afraid to step or that's going to be afraid to step into the corner and shoot. But you know, I think that, you know, if you want to play Juancho, he's not going to start next year. There's no way. I don't think there's any conceivable way that you can play Juancho next to Cat and D'Lo and Beasley, because then you're looking at 2.5 negative defenders. Because who know? I mean, Towns, I think, isn't really as much of a negative defender as everybody thinks he is. And Beasley,
but still a negative.
Yeah,
but still a negative, but not.
But he's not. He's not like a D'Angelo Russell. I would not classify Towns as a liability on defense. Yeah. And I'd classify Russell as a liability on defense. And I think Beasley will be better too.
Yeah.
And those guys just like to compete too, which helps. And so I think when you start thinking about lineups with Juancho, you know, you probably need Culver out there just because Culver's got length and the agility laterally to stay with guys, to funnel guys into, you know, into post bigs, you know, down in the lane and down in the block. You know, and then you need another center, but like, Naz Reid and Juancho, that would just be the bloodiest blood in the water for any offensive players you could probably come up with.
You can still survive that a little bit if they're playing 15-20 minutes a game, but you can't survive it if you're banking on Juancho to play 30-35 minutes a game.
Yeah.
You need someone next to Towns who can really cover some of his holes.
And what's really tough is that, obviously, you know, would Juancho have played 29 minutes a game if Towns was there for the final 13 games? Probably not. But because that wasn't the case, you know, it's kind of tough to extrapolate that, you know, sample size that we have and say, okay, how is that going to work with Towns? But you know, I think kind of what we're getting at is just the writing is kind of there on the wall. You know, I don't really, in terms of free agency, I do not see Juancho getting anything more than 3 for 15. I just don't see it. I think
that's exactly the same number as I had down as well. That's the number I'd be pretty comfortable with. 3 for 15, half of the MLE
Go ahead.
You'd be pretty happy with that. You'd be pretty happy with the 3 for 15, I was going to say. I think then you can put him on the bench and you don't feel like you're overpaying a bench player. You can trade him eventually if, you know, if it comes to that and not feel like he's an anchoring contract that you can't get rid of. If he does grow defensively or he does become a really good shooter or a more well-rounded offensive player, then he's really good value at $5 million a year. I don't think the market will be a super big for him. It's pretty depressed in general, I think, with all that's going on with the coronavirus and whatnot. So I think 315, they might even start a little bit lower than that, maybe, you know, lowball him, I guess, a little bit, negotiate with him. But I would be pretty annoyed if they went anything over, you know, maybe 3 for 18.
Yeah, if I'm sitting in Gerse's chair, I'm not paying Juancho Hernan Gomez more than $5 million a year. I probably wouldn't pay more than $4 million a year personally. Because,
especially with some of the players I have on the roster, like, I think Vanderbilt could probably step into that role. He's not going to shoot threes, but if he could step into 10 to 15 minutes off the bench and he'd give you better defense, better rebounding, a better passer, and there's still spacing, a lot more spacing and shooting on the roster now, you know, with Beasley and whatnot. So if it comes down to it and you can't replace him in free agency, I think Vanderbilt at, you know, $2 million a year is better than Juancho anything over five.
I completely agree with that. And I think too that, you know, what do you need out of a guy who's going to be, you know, your bench four alongside Naz Reid? You're not going to need him to score because Naz Reid is going to be out there to try and be aggressive on offense. And if he's also out there with, you know, with McLaughlin, you know, McLaughlin, you know, proved the end of this year that, you know, he's more than capable of saying, you know what, F this, I'm going to the basket, and just putting his head down and going and finishing strong, you know, dunking on Clint Capella, you know, kicking out. I mean, he shot north of 40% from three, you know, and then, you know, you could also have, you know, a rookie off the bench too, that's drafted pretty highly, that's able to contribute right away offensively. You know, maybe you have,
well, yeah, they've got three picks, so there's always the way, you know, that's not an easy, but a pretty comfortable way to replace his value or to replace his position is you've got three draft picks. You can trade, you can use the pick. There's so many options that don't involve overpaying Juancho.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Gerse really values value and he understands value. And I think that's why there's such a heavy emphasis on, you know, using the Iowa team. You know, Naz Reid, Jordan McLaughlin, Jalen Noel, Keelan Martin, Jared Vanderbilt. Like, all those guys spent time down there and are playing in the same system, so they'll feel comfortable when they come up. And you know, the other thing I was talking, or I'd been thinking about, was I saw Derek Murray, who does some awesome draft stuff, I think for Babcock Hoops on Twitter, mentioned, you know, how let's start thinking about players, not as 82 game players, but as 16 game players. Like, is this person just going to get isolated and destroyed in like a 1-4 pick and roll? Or, you know, in the playoffs when the game slows down and there's a lot more isolation and just let's keep, you know, running ball screens and having the defense switch until we get a matchup we like, you know, that's still going to happen with when a bench guy's out there. Like, sure, is Juancho going to be out there in defense in the fourth quarter in a playoff series? Probably not. But you know, that can still happen in the first, second, and third quarters when, you know, he's going to be out there. And I just don't see Juancho as a guy who's going to say, oh, that could end up being like a sneaky good, you know, weapon or, you know, asset that the Wolves have. I just don't see that. I only see him, you know, just getting attacked. And, you know, we're at the point now where, you know, the Wolves have to start thinking about the playoffs. So we can't just say, all right, we need just to take this position from a 4 out of 10 to a 5 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10 to a 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking, you know, what is that going to look like in the playoffs? And I would much rather have Jared Vanderbilt go out there and just go hustle his ass off and play defense and just fly around and try and, you know, rebound the ball and play defense than, you know, have a guy who's going to be a huge liability on defense and, you know, and make, you know, two or three threes in a game.
I don't think there's a scenario where he ever looks good defensively on this team. There's just so many holes already on this team, especially the bigs. Towns is obviously not great. Russell and Beasley both give up a lot in point of attack, pitching and roll coverage. Naz Reid, although I've come around to Naz's defense a little bit more now that I've rewatched, I was really low on
him. Yeah, I have too.
I think he's actually a bit better than I thought he was, but he's still not a guy who's going to cover Juancho's weaknesses and make him look good.
Yeah,
that's what Minnesota need.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that too. I mean, you have two offensively minded centers in Towns and Naz Reid. You don't have a third guy that's going to play. Like, sure, you could have James Johnson be a small ball five because he's just a junkyard dog who's going to go in and hang and bang and fight dudes in the post for rebounds and on defense, which is awesome. But he's not a true five. And so I think that you're four, and Gerst has said this too in the media. You know, he says that, you know, if a guy's going to play the four, he's got to be defensively versatile on defense to a point where he can slide down and switch and guard, you know, where two or three on a possession if he needs to, but then also be able to guard a four or a five, you know, on any given possession. And that's just not Juancho. Like, yeah, he has the shooting aspect of it, but, you know, I really don't think that it's essential for the Wolves to have five shooters on the floor at one time, because I think that, you know, there's so many different lineup combinations that they can put together that have four shooters out there at any given time. Just think about it. I mean, the only real guys who can't shoot on the roster, I mean, I guess you could say Culver, but then after Culver and Okogie, I guess, like, who are the other two guys that are going to be out there that can't shoot or that can't make a wide open jump shot?
This team, so they've got the stigma, this team, that they can't shoot. And I think, obviously, we know that the whole team got overhauled, but that shooting problem that was such a big problem to start the season is pretty much eliminated fully. Like you said, Culver and Okogie, it's another can of worms whether they can mesh together on the team and they can play in lineups together. But outside of them, it's pretty much all players who can at least shoot at league average or higher. So I don't think keeping Juancho because he can shoot 40% from three
makes sense.
Makes sense, especially when he can't defend any position. Not like he can't defend up and guard small fives. He can't defend down and guard wings in switches. And if this team wants to switch everything like they were at the end of the season, I'm not sure if that's what they'll do when Towns is back. Like, they didn't really switch everything when Towns was healthy originally. But if they want to switch everything like they did in those last 10 games, they're not going to be able to do it with Juancho. He just got blitzed on screens. Even the Charlotte game I was watching the other night, Devontae Graham just hunted him all game. He was like, if you want to switch this screen and put Juancho on me, I'm going to take three steps back, I'm going to drive to the rim and destroy him, or I'm going to take three steps back and get him on his toes and I'm going to hit a three in his face. And that, you can't have that in your starting lineup, and you can barely have it in your bench.
Yeah, and it's in that game specifically, I really remember watching it. It was just so disappointing that he kept getting continually killed, and Rhino just left him out there, which was tough. It kind of brings me to the other thing I was going to say too. So it sounds like the Timberwolves are going to play six games, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, get it to 70 games
as of today, as of Friday. And that's obviously not official or not confirmed. But, you know, in those last six games, I mean, if Jared Vanderbilt is not playing in those last six games, I'm going to be beside myself. I think they really owe it to themselves to kind of see what he can do. The competition level might not be at the same level because who knows what players are going to say, sure, I'll go down to Disney World and play for 2 weeks and then go home. And we just have no idea. That's why I think it's just going to be so vital to try and throw guys out there like as kind of a mini tryout for next year's team. And you know, I think that, you know, the more that they think long and hard about it, you know, Gerst is not a guy who's going to stick by his comments saying, you know, he hopes that Juancho is here for the rest of his career. Like, do you really think that Gerson Rosas really wholeheartedly believes that he wants Juancho Hernangómez to be a Timberwolf for the rest of his career?
I don't think
he really cares.
I think he's the time. I think Rosas is one of the guys who he's really supportive of his players while they're here, but he's not scared to cut ties with them as soon as he sees an option to make this team better, which I appreciate because this team needs to get better. And if I don't think he's, you know, naive enough to think that Juancho is this perfect starting four.
Yeah, and the players respond to that. You know, what did we see the first game at Target Center after the trade deadline? Who was there sitting in Rosas's box?
Yeah.
It was Robert Covington.
We spoke about that last week. That's such a big thing.
Which is awesome. And the fact that, you know, Gerst had nothing but glowingly positive things to say about Robert Covington, and obviously it had cultivated a really great relationship with Roko, and Roko understood what what Gerst is all about. And I think that, and that's why he came back. And, you know, obviously there's some players who are going to say, you know, screw this guy. You know, this guy traded me. I wanted to be here. But, you know, I don't think you can argue about getting traded to Houston and go playing in the playoffs, but that's a different subject. But, you know, I think that, like you said, he's the guy that's going to try and, you know, be sunshine and roses behind the scenes, and, but also keep it real with guys and say, you know, look at what I just did in February. I mean, I was looking at the Timberwolves synergy profile for individual players, and like more than half the guys in that list in parentheses next to it just said not on the team anymore. You know, yeah. And he's ruthless. He's not afraid to move guys around. And especially if you've got the fourth pick and a certain player from USC that we won't talk about right now, is still there on the board. You know, I would be foaming at the mouth to go up and take Onyeka Okongwu. But I think it's just abundantly clear that, you know, Wancho is not the guy, or not the guy for any team, really. One that's going to be a playoff team and, you know, wants to have playable guys out there. And two, which is, you know, probably the case for the Wolves, when you have two offensively minded fives, I think it's tough to have an offensively minded four and an offensively minded five. You know, I can't really think of a team that's been really good and that's won that in recent years that has had that. I mean, the Spurs had, you know, Boris Diaw and Duncan. The Warriors had, you know, Draymond and Bogut, you know, and Draymond, or KD and Draymond too. And I mean, and even Cleveland, like Kevin Love was offensive minded, but then you had Tristan Thompson behind him. So like all these teams that do really well and are successful in the playoffs, nobody has two offensively minded bigs. I think that that's just something that the Wolves are kind of going to come to realize. And like when the rubber meets the road, he's just not a great fit. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like it was a good experiment, and I'm glad that he really played well and thrived. But, you know, I'm just terrified that this mid-level exception is going to be some nonsensical, like 3 for 21 or 3 for 24 or something like that, because they're going to be afraid that some other team's going to want to grab him. I don't see a playoff team wanting to grab him, especially in this economy, in this climate, with coronavirus.
And if they do, it's going to be for cheap as well.
Right. Because no one else has cap space. You know, I could see him going to Charlotte and playing with his brother, or, you know, the Knicks. The Knicks always need another power forward. you know, I just don't think that his future should be in Minnesota. And I think there's, you know, I'm excited to see what Gerson has in mind for that. Whether it be with the first pick, you know, the Timberwolves own pick this year, or the 16th pick or the 33rd pick, like all three of those places, you'll be able to get a guy who is either better than Wancho right now, or he just has much, you know, is much better value. I think in a draft like this, in a free agency class like this, where, you know, it's not as front loaded, it's a lot more back loaded. I think being able to make smart.
Yeah. There's a lot of depth.
Being able to get good value, I think, is going to be important. Like, is everybody's board for free agency and for the draft going to be wildly different? Yeah, of course it will be. And I think trying to, you know, adjust for that and create your own board to a point where, you know, you have a couple guys circled at certain spots, or certain days of free agency where you say, okay, if this guy's still around, this is what I've got to address. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, with a guy like Sachin Gupta and, you know, and a great, you know, international scouting team, you know, the Wolves assistant GM, I don't want to butcher his name, but I think it's Gianluca Pasciucchi, I think is his name. Rosas, all those guys have backgrounds in international scouting or in, you know, trades and in analytics like Sachin does. So, you know, they've got all the ammo they need there to, you know, to really make the best informed decisions. And I just don't think that Wancho would be, you know, something that they would do. And I'd hope that they don't kind of, you know, think with their heart and not their head, when it comes to that. And you know, I don't think that Gerson has, considering, you know, everything that happened at the trade deadline. So, like if they were to replace Wancho, Personally, like, how would you do it, or what would your thought process be in terms of, these are the things that I am looking for in a four, rather than what Gerst might think. But like, if you were sitting in his chair, and you were tasked with, how do I replace Wancho, or how do I upgrade Wancho while also getting a guy at great value? How would you address that?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to look at it. Sorry. First, I think, is whether you're going to try and trade for this player, or whether you're going to try and pick them up with the mid-level, or pick them up in the draft. If you're going to try and trade for a guy with a big name, a bigger name, like, you know, an Aaron Gordon or someone like that, who brings a bit of what Wancho has, but is better on D and more dynamic offensively, then I think obviously you're going to give up probably, you know, Culver or Okogie and a pick and maybe James Johnson. So you're going to gut your roster a little bit more, but then you're going to get a player who can do a bit of everything and who slots straight into that starting role. And then I think if you're going to, which I think is less likely, I know Rosas will definitely swing for the fences as much as he can. He's made that abundantly clear from day dot that he's not scared about, you know, going all out for this team, and he wants to build a team that can really compete.
Which I love, but, because I don't think that Minnesota is the top of a place in free agency where, you know, a guy's just going to come and love it. I think that, like, it's part of the reason why D'Lo left. Like, if you could go get the bag and live in San Francisco, I mean, hell, I'd much rather go do that. And I love Minnesota. Yeah. I've lived in Minnesota, you know, most of my life. But I think it's important that then once D'Lo gets in the building, you know, what did he just say with Ethan Casson on the all staff, you know, meeting yesterday or 2 days ago? He said, you know, from the moment I stepped off the plane here, this felt like home, and I've never been treated better than I've been treated here in Minnesota. And I think it takes things like that happening for, you know, people to want to come here from free agency. But I think it's smart, like you're saying, that, you know, he realizes that, you know, I'm not going to go sign a Kevin Love or, like, you know, a big name power forward in free agency that's going to want to come play in Minnesota.
That's just not going to happen.
Yeah. But anyways, you were saying,
yeah. So I think there's that option where you go out and you try and trade for a big name, a power forward or another wing, or even a small forward, I guess, that can slide up to the power forward. I think it's probably more unlikely that he gets that done, just because of the climate that we're in at the moment. Minnesota doesn't have, they have assets, but I don't think anyone's clamoring for the chance to, you know, get James Johnson and the sixth pick in one of the worst drafts of the decade. But there's definitely still value there. But I think more likely is you go and get a guy with the MLE, or you go and get a guy in the draft, and you just try and kind of pick and choose skill sets that you need. And I think the main one would be defense. Obviously, like we said, they need defenders. They need guys who can still shoot enough to keep defenses honest, because you don't want to trot out lineups that do have Culver, Okogie, and another non-shooter in it, because then you've no chance without any spacing at all. But I think if you can get a guy who can shoot a little bit, it doesn't have to be a star. I can't think of a name off the top of my head, but someone who can shoot at league average, play good enough defense to survive, I think that's the guy you go and spend $8 million a year on, rather than the four or the five that we've been talking about with Wancho. And then in the draft, there's not a lot of power forwards in the draft, I don't think. I think there's wings that could play as a small ball four, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the kind of thing that Rosas was looking for. I, as people know who listen to this podcast, I love Devin Vassell. I don't think he's a power forward, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if Minnesota got him at six and tried to play him at the four.
Yeah.
Or just play him in that wing bunch. Or a guy like Isaac Okoro, I think, could do the same thing. Both really, really good team defenders, good individual defenders too. Okoro is, I was watching him again over the last week, and he's such a good,
he's fun,
on ball defensive player. He can't shoot at all, which kind of hurts the, you know, league average shooter who can play defense. But
you talk about guys that just want to go get up in some dude's face and just get physical,
yeah,
and defend him like there's no tomorrow.
He's got a lot of Josh Okogie about him, but at 6'7" and 230 pounds, he's just a beast. He's gonna be a really good defensive
player. I think he's gonna be like Marcus Smart. I think is, if you put a gun to my head and said, you know, who would you compare him to? I'd say a bigger, bulkier Marcus Smart, who's not as good of a shooter, but is a better athlete.
And a really good driver and scorer around the rim too. I think that gets overlooked with him because he can't shoot. Everyone thinks he's just this complete minus on offense, but he can really get to the ring, finish with both hands.
And he's got a sneaky quick first step too, and he's not afraid to bang out on somebody either, which is, I mean, there are plenty of dunks he had at Auburn this year where, you know, I think you tweeted out one earlier today, where he had Neesmith guarding him, and he just exploded at the rim, and the whole arena just went nuts. I'm sitting here thinking too about free agency. Like, I think that you could get really good value. Like Paul Reed, I think from DePaul is another name to keep an eye on. I think he'd probably be around at 33, who's a crazy versatile defender. I think he's probably one of the most slept on guys in the draft, but, you know, you could have, you know, Precious Achiuwa at 16 is a guy who might not be able to do it right away, but it could definitely, I think he's got boatloads of potential on defense, especially. And then obviously Okongwu is the guy who's at the top of my board for the Wolves from a Wolves perspective. But, you know,
I just finished, which was awesome. Go read that.
That was an A+ article that you put out today. That was a lot of fun.
I really like Okongwu. I really like him. I don't think they'll draft him just because he's just not the archetype that Rosa seems to be looking for.
But he's exactly what they need.
He's exactly what they need. He'd be perfect in that four role. And if you get him in the draft, you still have to pay him around $7 to $9 million.
He's worth it.
Top five pick. But you get him locked down in that rookie scale deal and you get full control of him for at least the next 6 years, probably.
Yeah.
So
used the word God, he'd be a godsend for Minnesota. And I thought that was a perfect encapsulation of it. A perfect way to describe that. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about guys who are going to be free agents next year that, you know, we could get with the MLE. You know, I don't know off the top of my head how much cap space we're going to have. You know, obviously, because, you know, we'll get whatever the number is, 18 million or 19 million when, you know, Evan Turner's off the books. But you know, that's probably just kind of getting you closer to even rather than, you know, putting you back in the green. But I look at guys like a Jamichael Green from the Clippers is a guy who's a versatile defender, who's big, who can knock down a three, who's not afraid to, you know, step out on the perimeter and guard somebody. That's one that I think would be awesome.
Jeremy Grant. Jeremy Grant would be a really good pickup.
Jeremy Grant trying to, and I wrote about him about how he would be, you know, a great fit probably a month or two ago.
Yeah.
About how I'd be all in on that. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that Denver has used him the right way. His numbers have gone down significantly since being in Denver compared to his time, as a starter in Oklahoma City. So that's a guy you might be able to get, you know, for pennies on the dollar. Maybe you have to give up 16, but I'd give up 16 to get Jeremy Grant. And then, you know, I look at another guy who I think just based on what you like, I think that you'd be all over this guy too. And that guy's Harry Giles from the Kings.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Harry Giles. He can't really shoot, but he has enough range where I think he'd definitely develop a three-point shot. And he's been woefully underutilized at Sacramento. And he's unrestricted free agent as well. So.
And it's crazy, too. He's had double ACL surgery. He's still crazy agile for a guy that is had double ACL surgery laterally and can really get up and block shots and kind of wreak havoc defensively, which would be great. And another guy who really coming into his time here, I thought was going to be a lot better, but wasn't, was Noah Vonleh. I thought that Noah Vonleh really showed flashes in New York last year of, you know, a guy who's a versatile defender who could get out on the perimeter. He was always the person that the Bucks put on Giannis, and he played very well against Giannis on defense. Last season, so I wouldn't be opposed to trying to bring him back in favor of instead of Wancho, if we actually, you know, let him go out there and play defense the right way, considering now that we have, you know, better guys on offense, I just think that, you know, he was asked to do a little too much on offense. But, you know, and then, you know, I have no idea what a guy like Christian Wood's going to go for, or Marvin Williams. You know, Marvin Williams, yeah, he's 34, but another guy that I think, you know, could be a decent plug and play guy.
Yeah.
I think my ideal option, you know, if money wasn't part of the equation, would be Serge Ibaka.
Yeah.
Just cause he's played for one of the, I think, in my opinion, the best defensive coach in the NBA, and Nick Nurse. And you know, I think would be a great guy to get in there to mentor Jared Vanderbilt. Cause when Serge Ibaka came in the league, he couldn't shoot at all. And I think it really took him 3 or 4 years of playing full time before he started to shoot. And instead he just murked people on defense and was really good around the rim, and was a tremendous rebounder, which I think, you know, check for Jared Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
And you know, he got paid $21 million, or I think it was 21.7 this year in Toronto. And I don't see him getting, you know, 21.7 next year, but if you were able to use, you know, the full MLE plus a little bit of cap space on Serge Ibaka, I would 100,000% go do that.
I think Ibaka, again, it would be an absolute perfect fit. I'm not sure how realistic it is that they actually get him, but I think...
Oh, it's not realistic at all,
There's not a guy out there that probably fits the mold better than Ibaka, especially because he'd be the adult in the room. He'd be perfect veteran leader for this team. He's obviously just come off a championship run. He's reinvented himself so well, Ibaka. He went from just that shot blocking, you know, ring dynamite to 3-point shooting. He hits mid-range shots at a really high rate, and he still blocks enough shots. He still plays really solid team defense. I think, like you said, if there was a guy that you could reach for unrealistically that's still kind of realistic if they had the money, it'd be him. I think a dude who's at the top of my list who is completely unrealistic, and I know a lot of people agree with this, is Jonathan Isaac. I think Isaac would just be the perfect fit next to Towns. He was so good defensive this year. It's if you haven't watched, yeah, go and watch some Jonathan Isaac full games from the start of the season, or everyone listening.
I think
he's awesome.
I think too, if he struggles offensively early on next year, I would not be surprised if his value goes down a little bit. If he's not able to shoot it as well next year, if his value goes down a little bit, if there's just going to be vultures waiting in the wings for him.
Yeah, there's a decision needs to be made in Orlando on their power forward situation. Aaron Gordon's not a small forward. Either is Isaac, and there's also Mo Bamba there as well, and Vucevic. So they're trying to fit, you know, they're trying to give starters minutes to four players right now, all in the same two positions.
And Cam Birch too.
Yeah.
He's a big
so
body
think,
for there too.
So
it's tough.
There's definitely decisions that need to be made there. I think that's why so many people are in on Aaron Gordon, or who are, you know, kind of projecting Aaron Gordon to be moved somewhere, and potentially Minnesota, because he seems to be the odd man out, as Isaac's a little bit younger and probably a better help to a really good team.
Yeah, I'm kind of off the Aaron Gordon train for a lot of reasons. I don't think he'd be a good fit in the locker room whatsoever, and I think that that's something that's really important, considering, you know, I think that he and Kat would clash quite a bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I think he's overpaid.
Definitely.
So I wouldn't be willing to handicap the team financially for Aaron Gordon. And he thinks he's a way better 3-point shooter than he is too, which is unfortunate. But yeah, if you wanted me to give you realistic options, you know, the guys that I'd really think long and hard about are Harry Giles, Jamichael Green, and then, you know, someone like maybe down near the bottom of guys that are going to be available, like, you know, a Marvin Williams, or, yeah, you know, and then you start to get into guys in the draft, and Jared Vanderbilt. So, you know, I think they've got a lot of options available to them. But again, I think it's just about maximizing value, especially, you know, if you're a team that's that isn't completely cap strapped, but, you know, I wouldn't say it's a team that that has a lot of financial flexibility. And I think considering the fact that, you know, Rosas has kind of played this long game all along of the summer of 2021, we know that that next summer or fall now, hopefully, if that's how it's going to work, that, you know, that free agency class is going to be loaded. And, you know, there's a couple things that I think that they need to think about too this offseason as it relates to the power forward position. Is the power forward for the Timberwolves is not going to be asked to do a whole lot, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
Relative to other positions. And the Timberwolves have two guys on the team right now that are older than 25. They have, well, Jake Layman's 25, but then you have Evan Turner, who's going to be gone, who's 30, and then you have James Johnson, who's 32. So realistically, James Johnson has been playing on a team with a bunch of dudes that were 7, 8, 9, 10 years younger than him, and just looks like he's having a ball doing it. And like, the NBA is not 2K. It is not my GM in 2K where you can just get a bunch of dudes that are 23 and 25 and put them together and that it'll all work. I understand Rosas's timeline, but I also think that it's not really addressing the elephant in the room of how many adults are on this team.
Yeah.
Like, you still have Carl, who does, you know, I love Carl to death and I think he's an awesome dude, but I think sometimes he can be a little too emotional on the court and it can kind of spill into other things. It can last for 3 and 4 possessions at a time. And, you know, I think that having a steady hand like D'Lo there and, you know, his best friend in the world, I think is going to help him a bunch. But, you know, everybody else, like, guys that are coming into the league, like, sure, you can look up to a guy like Jake Layman, who's 25. But I still think that, you know, this team really lacks playoff experience and playoff experience from guys that have actually legitimately played semi-big minutes in the playoffs. I think James Johnson is really the only guy. I mean, and D'Lo, too. D'Lo played in the series last year, but they've really got to start looking at trying to get a four who does what they're looking for, but can also be an adult in the room, considering because they have, you know, they have good options coming up because they're probably going to draft one. Plus you have Vanderbilt. So I think your biggest need for a four is all those things you listed earlier with the versatility and, you know, and the switchability, but also a mentorship aspect. I think that that's something that James Johnson has been awesome this year with, and is something that I really hope they can find too, because I think that that's also a need. And I think that it's probably important that that guy isn't, you know, a star. And I think that the four is kind of that perfect sweet spot where they'll play important minutes. So they'll be out there with those guys, but they're also not going to be asked to do all that much to a point where they'll really be able to focus a lot of their energy on, you know, on working with guys and mentorship off the floor, which I think is a huge part.
I think they need to be just gap fillers almost on the court. They need to do the things that Towns and Russell don't do well. They don't need a star per se, but they need a star in that role, I think, for them to be a really good team.
100%.
Obviously, we all know Robert Covington is literally the perfect player to be playing there right now, but obviously to get Beasley, who's on the same timeline as Russell and Towns, and to get the pick, you have to give up Covington. It made sense. I still think it makes sense. But that's the kind of player you need, where he's just a gritty, do what you need, don't let the ego get in the way kind of player at the four. And like you said, I don't think it needs to be on that quote-unquote timeline. I think your timeline is for the guys who you want to play for your team for the next 10 years, say. Apart from that,
right,
I think you just fill it with players who help you win now. You can always go and find, you know, another James Johnson in 2 or 3 years if you have to. Or the, you know what I mean? You don't need to have every player on your team be 24 years old. Some players need to be 20.
100%.
Some players need to be 29 and, like you said, have that playoff experience. Other players need to be even younger and watch guys who are, you know, 24 and see where they are, where they can get in 5 years. So I think there needs to be a mix of all of it. There needs to be that adult in the room, and there needs to be, versatility in age and mentality and leadership styles. I think all of that is how you make a really good locker room and a really good team on the court as well.
100%. And you know, the example that I kind of look to is like the original version of the Warriors, the 2014-15 Warriors. You know, that team, sure, your core was Steph, Draymond, Clay, and Harrison Barnes, all guys that were, you know, 20 in the to the 20 and to 25 or 26 range. But then on the bench, you had guys like David West or David Lee. I don't know if David Lee, but still, like David West, David Lee, Sean Livingston, Leandro Barbosa, all those guys that are, you know, veteran guys that can come in, you know that they're going to play the right way, the way you need them to. But then they also showed that, you know, they could cycle those guys out, like Barbosa retired, David Lee retired, David West retired. And they brought in these new guys with the new wave Warriors on the bench that worked well, that just, like you said, were stars in their roles, which I think was, which is crucial too. That is, if you're going to have guys in a playoff team, you have to understand that one series, they might play more than they did in the last. And that's where, like you said, just being a star in your role is so, so important.
And if you are going to be a really good team, by the time that those younger core players, so your Towns and your Russells and your Beasleys in Minnesota case, by the time they're 28 and, you know, yeah, the older guys that you brought in to help them are out of the league and doing whatever, then Towns and Russell and Beasley are the veterans. So they don't need, you don't need, you know, 32-year-olds as much when Towns and Beasley and Russell get to 28 themselves. But you need those guys there now to help them transition and to be the calm head and the leader. You need them now to help that transition into veteran leadership by your young core.
Yeah, I think too that, you know, having kind of that bridge, if that makes sense, is really important. And that if you're not able to have, you know, those bridge guys that are able to make it work and then can move on, and that you can kind of fill and rotate new pieces in there, you know, having those guys are going to be crucial, like you said. And you know, I think that, again, it kind of comes back to the value game. All those guys that Golden State had were great value pieces. And I think that, you know, those guys probably knew what they were getting into, in the sense that they knew they were going to play for a winner. And so, you know, they're probably more willing to play on a more team friendly deal. But I think for a team like Minnesota, you know, that probably isn't going to attract guys like that, it's going to be important to sell them on, you know, what they have going. And if you have to pay a guy, you know, $3 or $4 million instead of veterans minimum, you know, I think that's okay, as long as you have the right guy there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something that kind of remains to be seen, and it will be kind of interesting to see how Rosas, you know, goes about doing that. Just because I hope he doesn't expect that, you know, a team full of 25 and 26 year olds is going to be really successful in the playoffs.
Yeah. And I think we got off topic a bit with Wancho, but it all comes back to that. We don't think that he's really that guy that fits in that mold. He's not the veteran leader. He's not the defensive presence. He can shoot, but we don't need shooters as much anymore. So I think that all ties into that. And at the end of the day, I think Wancho, I think there's a place for Wancho in the league. I definitely don't think he's a guy who should be, you know, in Europe or in Australia even. You know, he's definitely an NBA player. I think there's a place on the team for him, especially if he can keep up that hot shooting. And I think he'll definitely get a contract this year because of the way that he shot with Minnesota on pretty high volume and decent efficiency as well. So overall, I just don't think that he's the best guy for Minnesota. He's still a good, decent player, but we need players who fit around Towns and Russell. That's what this team needs, and that's what I think Rosas will go for. I agree. I don't think Rosas is naive enough to think that Wancho is the be-all and end-all. But if you can get him back on you know, 3 years, $12 million, I don't think I'll be angry at that. And if he's playing 15 minutes a game, I still think he can add value as a shooter. But he's not the starter, that's for sure.
Right. And the other thing, too, is if you get a guy at $4 million a year, you know, there's still a really easy case to be made for, you know, having that guy used as a throw-in piece in any trade that you had. It wouldn't be hard to, you know, let yourself out of that contract situation it would be a relatively easy fix there. So like you said, like if it's a short contract, you know, I'd love to see him back just for, you know, the 82 game aspect. But I would not go any more than, you know, 3 for 12 really. Would kind of be my number, for bringing him back.
I think we're in agreement there, but we're at about an hour and 10 minutes now, so I think we've done all right on Wancho today. I really appreciate you coming on, man. It was a great conversation, and I think it'll be not the last time you come on for sure, so I'd love to have you back at some stage, especially when basketball ramps up a little bit and we can actually get some in-game kind of topics to talk about and stuff.
Yeah, I'd love to, man. It was a great time, and I hope everything continues to get better for you guys down there in Australia, and you know that everybody in your family, yourself included, stays healthy and sane during all this, and hopefully soon we'll have some more basketball to talk about.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you too. And just for all the listeners, we're officially on Spotify now and Apple and every other platform that you get your podcasts on. So go and subscribe there, leave a rating, write a review, whatever floats your boat. Just the listens are really appreciated. So thanks everyone for listening, and I'll see you guys next week.